You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, a sack newsreader, business speak, snubbed by celebrities, the right way, and the pretend iPod.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar, edition number 97, no less. I'm Magnus Shaw, and I can still hear him saying he'd never break the chain. It's Terence Stackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Oh, you're sounding a bit glum, old chum.
I just can't get over the JLS split. Oh. Where will I get my half-price sofas now?
Sofas? They don't sell sofas, you idiot. JLS are a boy band.
Oh, they do sofas and they're a pop group.
Yeah, if you like. Yeah, that's right, they do sofas.
Oh, I see. Well... Oh, that's okay then. Well, even JLS splitting up their pop singing and half price sofa career this week, they can't have had as bad a week as AJ Clemente, who on his first day as newsreader on North Dakota's KFYR was sacked after his first two words on air. Which were this week the F word and the S for sugar word. And that was first two words that he uttered in his new career on KFYR in North Dakota. And despite the sort of social media campaign that's been running this week to save AJ, hashtag save AJ, he's been on Twitter, has Mr. Clemente, and announced he's been fired by KFYR. And he was starting his new career as a news anchor on this station, and as I say, much of those two words at the start, not realizing that his microphone was live and that you're actually on air. And he said on Twitter, he said, "Unfortunately, KFYR has decided to let me go. Thank you to them and everyone in North Dakota for the opportunity and everyone for the support." And if you go on YouTube, which we both have, I mean, you can clearly hear him saying these words. And his co-host, Van Tu, she sort of introduces this fellow on their evening report show, evening report on KFYR. And poor fella, he tries to regain his composure and he gets all mixed up and he stumbles and he goes all over the place. And the news director for KFYR, Monica Hannon, said, "I want to apologise for an incident that occurred prior to our early newscast this evening when one of our employees used a profanity on the air. He didn't realise his microphone was on, but still that's no excuse." And then she says in a kind of Bono kind of way, "All we can do at this point is for ask for your forgiveness, and I offer my personal assurance that I will do my best to ensure that nothing like this ever happens again under my watch." So, was this the right punishment for AJ Clemente, or have KFYR overreacted on this one, Magnus Shaw?
I don't imagine they had a lot of choice, really. As we know, the American networks and affiliates are governed completely by the advertising market, and the advertisers in America, or the corporate America, is very conservative, very right-wing, and tends to lean towards the religious, and... this kind of stuff will not stand. I would have thought within moments, various representatives of the advertisers were blazing a trail down the phone lines to the station in complaints. And if the advertisers aren't happy, then the station has to, take profound and severe actions to regain the ground. So I don't really think they had a lot of choice. One wonders what the kind of training he'd undergone.
It didn't look like much, frankly.
No,
did
it didn't really.
That's his first appearance.
Broadcast 101 says if you're near a mic, whether you think it's on or off, you don't let fly with F-bombs and S-bombs or any other verbal bombs, do you? Just in case. It's like, don't point an unloaded gun at somebody just in case. It's exactly the same thing. So I do feel sorry for him. It's obviously... a break that he relished, is his first step in a broadcasting career. Maybe he'll be able to recover from it, but at the moment his dream's dead, and that's a bit sad. But it couldn't have ended any other way, I don't think, really.
No, as you say, it's an NBC affiliate, so although it's a local station to Bismarck, North Dakota, those
the big guns at NBC and the advertisers would not have been amused. This happened a few days ago this week, and immediately he was mocked on Letterman on the top 10 list.
Yes.
a couple of days ago. But then he appeared as a guest on Letterman the following day, and he also appeared on Today on American TV as well, and saying that he wanted to have a second chance somewhere. And he's also been on Inside Edition, so he's probably more well-known than he could ever have dreamed.
Yes. But, yeah, his profile has risen considerably, but that's very different from getting rehired.
With
a station anywhere who is in hock to its advertisers, and they all are. They all are, yeah.
First thing I ever taught, I don't know if anybody ever gave me any advice, but I always considered, as you mused upon a few moments ago, that if I was ever within any form of range of a microphone, you have to assume that it's live always,
yes,
every time, yeah, because you just never know. As many broadcasters have learned their cost through the years and through the ages. But we'll keep a lookout for AJ Clementi. I don't imagine he'll be assigned as NBC's correspondent at the Vatican just yet, but we'll see if he bounces back in American TV somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I once worked for a broadcasting company, and in the studio where there were a lot of people working, editors and broadcasters, there was a huge sign that said, "Don't frighten the horses," which meant don't walk in here saying, "Where's my effing tea?" or "Oops, I've stubbed my effing toe." You know, it was shorthand for that. The big sign that said, "Don't frighten the horses."
Don't frighten the horses. I think, doesn't that come from originally from Mrs. Patrick Campbell, who says, talking about, frankly, gay people, and saying, you know, that she didn't mind what they did, as long as they didn't do it in the street and frighten the horses.
Yeah, basically.
I think
it sounds like the yes.
We've probably all been in meetings in our lives where time seems to have stood still while someone in a cheap suit tells us that they're going to run an idea up a flagpole or set up a Pathfinder project. Yesterday, The Guardian gave 10 examples of the worst of management speak. Stephen Poole in The Guardian actually wrote this story, and it provided some amusement for us. It was 10 examples there, and a couple of them that he refers to are, one, going forward, which people say in meetings, well, we've got to be going forward with this. I mean, they just mean, well, from now or in the future. But as Stephen says, if you say we're going forward, it implies, as he says, thrustingly strategic process, even though none is likely to be made as long as the working day is made up of funereal meetings where people say things like going forward.
Well,
just one more. End of play. Managers may say to you, we need this project done by the end of play. And again, he says it stems from a hope that infantilized workers are more docile. A manager who tells you to do something by the end of play is trying to hypnotize you into thinking you're having fun. So, Magnus Shaw, can I ask you to respond to this by close of play, please?
Well, I think the danger with this is that we mock the ones that we never use as being utterly ridiculous and conveniently overlook the ones that we do use. In advertising, end of play is standard, it's operating procedure. I mean, people always refer to end of play, it's meaning when before the client goes home, really, is what it tends to mean, or at least before you go home,
or
both. And I've heard it, you know, every day for donkey's years, and it never struck me really as absurd. I mean, it's just quicker to say than before you go home, really, isn't it? So
it is. I don't mind that one quite so much.
It's more or less end of business, isn't it? So it doesn't make me cringe, but you know, perhaps that's just because I use it and I've heard it used so often. Going forward, the one you mentioned, it tends to get deployed when something appalling has gone wrong, hasn't it? You definitely hear it from politicians a lot. Unfortunately, the major banks took us to the brink of absolute penury. But going forward, yes. it's like, yeah, that's all dead and buried now. So everything's going to be gone. And there is no other way to go if you're referring to the passage of time, is there?
Yes, we haven't yet managed to go back in time. You're right. Apparently you can't have a problem anymore in an office. You've got you can call it an issue. I've always heard people say, "Well, no, it's not a problem; it's a challenge."
This is very American, isn't it? Problems have become issues, haven't they? Because of America, and
we don't work with people anymore. They're stakeholders. people across the office, and people with whom we may be having a meeting, yeah. They're stakeholders, people with an interest in what we're doing.
Yeah, surely that can be traced back to Blair, can't it? You know, Blair's philosophies was the Blair, stakeholder society, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It sounds very, very Mr. Blair, yes. Hello, Mr. Hussein. Saddam Hussein, are you there? Yes, I know you're a stakeholder, but have a cop of this. boom.
I've got a rather nice book here in front of me, actually, by a gentleman called Graham Edmonds, who's compiled many, many of these in a book whose title I can't really give you at the risk of the network.
NBC wouldn't allow you.
No, but it's the B-bomb bingo book. It's if you take my drift. So he's got some good ones in here. Here's one we hear a lot: out of the loop, or in or out of the loop. You know, it's a good way of saying don't blame me. I was out of the loop on this one. So
okay, I've written a few myself as well. So we do sort of one each. I came up with buzzworthy. This is a new one. I'm going to skip. So it's an idea that might generate interest. So it's you know, I would bring it in this sort of context. I say, you know, your ideas are uniformly awful. Can't you think of anything more buzzworthy?
Right. I've never come across that. That's quite awful, actually.
No, I made it up.
Oh, you made it up?
Yeah, I'm making it up.
Oh, you're making them up. I see. Oh, right. Okay, well. God bless you, because I'd have taken that to be an actual management speak word.
Yeah, buzzworthy. I'm going to bring it in. I'm going to bring these into yours and my. Whenever we have lunch, I'm going to say, oh, God, is that your only conversation topic? Haven't you got anything more buzzworthy?
Excellent. Yeah, well, I like that. I like that.
I've got a few more in a minute after your chaps, next one from your chat. I'm going to bring them all in.
Are you in possession of helicopter vision?
Oh, my God, helicopter vision.
What it means is that you're hovering over the project or the business, watching events as they happen and taking action accordingly. Helicopter vision in that one.
I'm going to bring in black sky thinking. Because it's just like pushing the boundaries even higher. So I'm going to say to you, you're stuck in the blue sky there. Try moving into space and giving me some black sky thinking.
Black sky thinking. Yes. How about a gatekeeper?
Yeah. Is that the bloke who lets you in and out of the car park?
Well, that would be nice, but of course these things are never literal, are they? No, this is like an editor or a final authority on something. So it's a person whose job it is to prevent low quality progressing is a gatekeeper.
Chartists. I'm going to name people, a group of people, Chartists. And these are people who spend all day in front of a flip chart.
Yes. And there's far too many of those, aren't there? There's a flip chart addict. There's a few here. Let me have a look. Getting out of first gear. Yes.
Getting out of first gear. Project. We've got to get this project out of first gear.
Accelerate, improve speed. Yeah.
Magnus, I'm going to ask you to stir fry that one. I'm going to say, allow me to stir fry my concept. Yeah. You're thinking wok. Yeah. Next time we meet, I'm going to say that to you. I've got an idea here. I'm going to say, let me stir fry my idea in your thinking wok.
I was just about to give an example of that without realizing I was about to use another one. So let me give you, obviously yours are made up, mine are genuine, breakout area.
Oh, yes. Mm. And we could pick on that at the BBC.
Apparently,
breakout areas. soft areas. Kangaroo rodeo. This is what I call when no one takes charge. So it's like you say, like, oh God, that last conference call was a total kangaroo rodeo. So it's like, you know, nobody was in charge. People just shouting ideas out and everybody's bouncing around and nobody's like, you know, taking a hold of the situation.
I like kangaroo that. I think that's very poetic. Imagine everybody strapped to the back of a kangaroo. And say, yeah. Low hanging fruit.
Oh, now who's that? Is that the lowest employees on the wage structure?
That's right. When management says, I'm afraid we're going to have some suggestions for who to let go in the next quarter, and people start talking about who's the low hanging fruit, who's dispensable, who's expendable. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, here's one I dreamed up today. I think I'm going to use this a lot. Knowledge vacuum. So it's basically someone who hasn't got a clue. So when somebody asks me something, I'm going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. I've got a knowledge vacuum in that area.
Yeah, you can think of many people who their entire personality could be covered with the phrase knowledge vacuum. Yes,
it kind of gives it some sort of solidity, some sort of weight. Does it sound a bit like there should be a government grant for people who have a knowledge vacuum
to fill their knowledge vacuum?
Yes. Yes.
How about the drinking in the last chance saloon? We're drinking in the last chance saloon on this one.
Oh, dear.
It's like we don't get it right this time. We're dead on this one. So, yeah.
Drinking in the last chance saloon. And speaking of drinking in the last chance saloon, here's my last one that I've written. And again, I'm going to use this. I'll probably again use this when I'm in conversation with yourself. rocks in my rucksack. That's what I'm going to say.
These are great. Brilliant.
Here's the context. I'd love to help you with your project, but I've just got too many rocks in my rucksack right now.
You're weighed down by the heftiness of your current projects.
The boulders in my backpack. The rocks in my rucksack.
Rocks in your rucksack. Yeah. I think the thing with the drinking in the last chance saloon is a real political one, isn't it? When some non-political organisation has been shown to be corrupt or inefficient, and a politician will always point at it, won't they, and say, well, you know, I can say, as far as that particular quango is concerned, they're drinking in the last chance. They're trying to suggest that, you know, any moment now the axe is going to fall. But of course, it's all doublespeak, isn't it? So that is their punishment, to have that said about them. Nothing further will ever happen.
Absolutely. Totally meaningless. Yeah. Usually thrown out by, as you say, politicians at newspaper editors when they've published a topless photograph of the member of the royal family or something. So, well, these tabloids, these red tops, they're drinking in the last chance saloon.
Yes, perfect. The red top press, perfect example of that, yes. When you know everything is just going to continue forever
and
as it ever
carries
goes.
On. Yeah. Yeah, same as it ever was.
Yes. I think we could revisit this with particularly focusing on politics rather than business, because there's a whole host of them in politics, isn't there? Yeah.
Oh, I'll write some more for another week then for our political masters.
Yes.
I tell you what, Magnus Shaw, what do you think is the most expensive autograph ever sold at an auction? Harry Styles? Nope. No. Magnus Shaw?
No. Unlikely.
Well, you never know. Esther Ranson? No. None of those. No. On June 22nd last year, George Washington's signed copy of the Constitution of Bill of Rights, 1789, in the USA, it sold for $9,826,500.
Yeah.
Just short of $10 million for George Washington's signature.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why. I just wonder whether the value wasn't inherent in the document. Obviously, you're getting the Bill of Rights there as well, aren't you?
You're getting the Bill of Rights personally signed by George Washington. Yeah. And he's like annotated all over it as well and made notes in the margins and things.
as he put things like, we'll come back to this, too many rocks in rucksack.
Yes.
Yeah. Up the flagpole with founding fathers.
See who salutes it. Yes. the winning bidder for this copy of the Constitution and Bill of Rights, absolutely wonderful name, the Mount Vernon Ladies Association of the Union.
Blimey, where did they get $10 million?
Where did they get $10 million from? That was going to be my question. Absolutely amazing. They're a non-profit educational organisation. And I was going to say, I bet the reason they don't make any profit is because they're splashing $10 million on a bit of paper with George Washington's signature.
Coffee
on
mornings.
It.
That's what it would be.
That's right. Yeah. Those muffins, those homemade muffins really add up.
Fair enough. It's a great thing to own, isn't it? Amazing thing to own.
Well, when we read about this and I told you about this, it set us thinking about the whole concept of autographs. And when I was 13, I was given a blank autograph book for my birthday, and I immediately set off to gain the signatures of Chelsea footballers. Uh-huh. And Bobby Chambling,
that must have been hard being as you grew up in Inverness.
Yeah, it would have been difficult, wouldn't it? Yeah. Fortunately, I was just up the road. Bobby Chamberlain, John Boyle, very kind. The signatures are in my little 13-year-old's autograph book. But Ron Chopper Harris snubbed me in 1968, and I've never forgotten
it. Was he in charge of Bomber Command at the time?
Chopper Harris is a great name. That's a real nickname from the 60s and 70s when football defenders used to have names like Chopper.
Yes, it speaks volumes for their style of play, doesn't it?
Yes, it really did. You know, he used to sort of tackle people and they'd end up in the front row of the stand, you know, of the people watching. But as I say, I've never forgotten being snubbed by Ron Chopper Harris in 1968. And so it begs the question, Magnus Shaw, have any famous people ever snubbed you? Unlikely, though, that could possibly be.
Oh, yeah. I've never been a great autograph hunter. Odd occasions in the distant past when I've asked for an autograph, it's usually gone quite well. I remember getting Tracy Austin and Chris Evert's autographs. I wasn't a tennis fan. My mum was the tennis fan, and we were in London. I was just a wee lad, and we were walking past the Royal Albert Hall, and they came out the back door. I mean, that just wouldn't happen now, would it? They just wandered out, still in their whites, and presumably to go and fetch their cars or whatever. There's no bodyguard, that's nothing. And this must have been, about 1975, something like that. Yeah, they just walked out of the back door. And my mum went, oh, good grief, there's Tracy Austin and Chris Evert. So go and ask them to sign this. She gave me a napkin, and there we go, yeah. So that went.
And were they kind to you?
Yeah, as far as I remember, yeah. I mean, I think they just said, hi, yeah, sure, and it was all over. You know, I think they were very, very used to signing autographs. But there have been occasions where...
That sounded like my love life. Oh, hi, sure, and it was all over. But anyway, sorry, go on.
That I can believe. Okay, yeah. But there have been the odd occasion where it's gone horribly wrong. Meeting famous people and they haven't been pleased to meet you. The most pronounced occasion was probably around the same time, 76 maybe, and there was a vintage car show on the Forest Recreation Ground in Nottingham. Listeners in Nottingham will know the Forest extremely well. That's the site of the Goose Fair, if that means. It was not Goose Fair time. It was a Sunday afternoon and they were having a vintage classic car show. I always used to ride my bike on the Forest Recreation Ground, so I wasn't particularly there for the cars, but I did cycle down to this event, and lo and behold, who was emceeing this do but voice of the Wombles, Bernard Cribbins. And
Railway Children.
Yeah,
and
Doctor Who, and absolutely, yeah. And I thought, good Lord, there's Bernard Cribbins. How fantastic. So I fished in my pocket and... All I had was a bus ticket, one of those long strip bus tickets.
You know, like conductors used to reel out.
Cranked his handle out. Okay, that's all I had in my pocket. I thought, that'll do. So I ran down to where Bernard was standing talking to some fellow. I think I was a polite young man. I'd like to think so. And I said, excuse me, Mr. Cribbins, would you sign my bus ticket for me, please? He said no and then dropped the F-bomb.
Oh, not to 10-year-old Magnus Shaw.
He told me to F off. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No, F off, he said, yeah.
Oh, actually, that's funny because I did see Band of Criminals. He didn't tell me to F off, but I was at a charity cricket match a few years ago. And Michael Parkinson's cricket match at Bray in Berkshire, just near the Beatles carvery. And
that's near the not Pat relevant. Duck, as I always say, yes.
Exactly. Yes. And, Bernard Cribbins was selling raffle tickets. He wasn't playing in the cricket match. Right. He was selling raffle tickets. Right. And he was coming round one way, and the very lovely Annabelle Giles was coming round the other way. And Annabelle Giles got to us first, and we say, you know, so raffle tickets, 5 for a quid or something. And I said, oh, yeah, fine, yeah, that's it. And then Bernard Cribbins was like, and they kind of crossed over, and he was still trying to sell tickets. And he came past and he said, raffle tickets. I said, oh, well, just bought a what do you call it? A list or a book?
A roll?
Or whatever.
A roll. A strip. A roll. Strip, that's it. Strip.
A strip. Yes. That's it. I couldn't think of the word. A strip from Annabelle Giles there. And he kind of was very grumpy about it. He didn't swear, but he was going, all right then. Okay, whatever, lads. Well, and went about his business. Well, so,
Well, I mean, neither of us know Bernard Cribbins, and he might be a splendid bloke, but there's comparable occasions there. I managed to get myself backstage at a Depeche Mode gig, very early Depeche Mode gig, before their first album.
Was that when Bernard Cribbins was there?
Yeah, me and Bernard, yes. We used to go and watch a lot of nascent electro-pop bands together, yes. On this occasion, I think Bernard was tied up with important Wombles business. So I managed to inveigle my way backstage. Again, this speaks of a different time, doesn't it? Because there was a time when, if you fancied it, you could go up to security, you know, stage right, and say, after the band had gone off, say, any chance of going through to talking to the band? Yeah, go on then. You can't imagine that now, can you? So we possed through and knocked on the dressing room door. Somebody opened it. Oh, hello, can we see the band? And we were ushered in and we sat there with Depeche Mode. Now, Andy Fletcher, Martin Gore, Dave Garn, were charm itself. I think they like I said, it was early days for them, so I think they were quite pleased to have some, you know, fans come and see them to talk to. And it was really noticeable that Vince Clarke was sat separate from the other three guys with his feet up on a low coffee table, just staring into space, and he really wasn't part of the hullabaloo at all, and certainly wasn't speaking to the other guys in the band. And every time we sort of said, you'd have enjoyed that, wouldn't you, Vince? You know, you were talking about things that they've been doing on tour and stuff, and he just grunted, you know. He was not in the place he wanted to be. And it was telling that, you know, in under 6 months he'd gone, of course, and formed the assembly in Yazoo and all that. So maybe, you know, we'd broken in on
their private hell.
Yeah, his imminent departure. He wasn't a happy bunny, and he really didn't want to talk to we fans. So we didn't think it was worth asking for an autograph, because he clearly wasn't going to give one. No. So, but he wasn't rude as much as a bit moribund. You know, he was didn't seem to be having a party.
I think these days, most, but not all, and we'll come to that in a minute, most famous people, if you like, are more aware that if they are grumpy or sort of snub somebody, that it's more likely to turn up on YouTube or certainly on Twitter or something. And, you know, it could be career-ending if it was particularly awful. But when I knew we were going to talk about this, bit of research, and the unfortunately named Ranker, Ranker, .com, yes, has listed the world's most valuable autographs. And actually, some of them are most valuable because people don't like to sign them, you know. Now, this is going to give you a golden opportunity, because in the top 10 at number 9 is Pelé.
Oh, it's a
go on.
Yes, not Pelé, not Pelé, but to his mum and dad, Edson Arantes do Nascimento.
Yeah, I gave you the chance there. he's in there. His autographs go at £750 a pop. These are for signed photographs. All of these are for signed photographs.
Mind you, if your name is Edson Arantes do Nascimento, you're going to restrict the number of times you write that down, aren't you?
You are. Or you're going to need a very large photograph to get all that on.
Certainly not a bus ticket.
No. Madonna's at £800. Bob Dylan's at £850. He doesn't like signing stuff, and Dylan memorabilia is rare. He doesn't give anything away. He gave a harmonica to a member of his wardrobe department during his 1974 tour, and that sold for £2,700.
Oh, fair enough.
So, Muhammad Ali, he doesn't sign many autographs at all because he's not very well. But the real rarity is when he's the signatures, signed photographs of him as Cassius Clay changed his name. Yeah. And they go for just under $18,000 in America.
Wow. But here's the thing, though, about I don't really get about buying and selling autographs. Because I think the original concept of the autograph was just some tangible proof that you'd met a certain person.
Yeah.
So if you've got their signature, you've obviously been in their presence at some point, and therefore it had that sentimental value. If you then sell that, then that sort of provenance has gone, hasn't it? So the person who buys it off you hasn't met that person, so I don't quite get that.
It has. And whenever I come across somebody famous these days who's surrounded by people wanting to get close to them, what everybody asks for these days, very fewer people than ever ask for an autograph. Everybody wants their photo taken with the personality in question.
That's right.
Because, of course, everybody's got that facility on their smartphone. Yeah. And all you see these days, people whipping out smartphones and the poor celebrity bending in to some person. And, can we just take it again? Oh, okay, But back to the signed photographs. Number five, J.K. Rowling.
Oh, really?
She's very reclusive.
Yeah, she is. That's right. Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. In 2009, a second-hand chair set an auction record because it's just a chair that you would get for £10 in a junk shop, but it sold for £20,000.
Okay.
And that was because it was the chair that J.K. Rowling sat on to write the first Harry Potter book in front of her PC.
Right. And I guess she'd certified that. I mean, you've got to have some proof there, haven't you?
Yeah, I suppose it had the shape of her buttocks on the chair. That's probably.
Somebody showed up at the Antiques Roadshow with the writing desk that Bram Stoker wrote Dracula at. I think it was a surprise. I had a couple of £1,000. I thought that would have gone for much more, but
well, you're right. Often these things aren't as valuable as people think. For example, our own dear Her Majesty the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II. She's at number four in this list. She very rarely gives signatures. Uh-huh. She signs birthday cards and Christmas cards. You know, 100 when people get to 100, which isn't too far away for me. She sends a personally signed birthday cards.
That's right, yeah.
£1,500 is all you'll get.
So many in circulation, I guess.
There you go. Paul McCartney, £1,600. He's at number three. Mm. Now, here's what I was saying about, not everybody wants to sign stuff. And, of course, Tiger Woods, he's at number two because he's a bit of a grump, his old Tiger.
Sure.
You know, he's one of the world's greatest golfers of all time, but he very rarely signs autographs for his adoring public. But even his recent, shall we say, ups and downs in his love life.
should probably say something else.
No, probably shouldn't. We're not an NBC station. £1,750.
All right, okay.
But who's at the top? £5,000 you can get for a signed photo. If you've got a signed photograph of this person, it's £5,000. Mm. It surprised me, but then when I thought about it.
Is it Sinatra?
No.
Presley?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'll give you a clue. Dum da dum. Dum da doo.
Oh, yeah. Sting?
No.
Neil Armstrong.
Yes, Neil Armstrong.
It can't be Sting, I was thinking.
No, it's not Sting.
Neil Armstrong, of course. Yeah.
If you'd have got a signed, you would have made more money if you'd got a signed photograph of Neil Armstrong 10 years ago. And held on to it, The value has gone up 1,000% in 10 years. Yeah. £5,000 you would get for Neil Armstrong's autograph. He stopped signing autographs very soon after the Apollo 11 mission because he discovered a barber was selling offcuts of his hair for $3,000.
Good grief.
And ever since he's refused to sign autographs, he turned down Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
And that £5,000, that was eclipsed by... Eclipsed,
yeah,
did you see?
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. He's just... Not just throwing this stuff together.
A bank check that he'd written.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was sold for $27,000.
Which so it was more than the value of the check, presumably.
Absolutely, very much was. It was a small-scale check, but instead of cashing it, the person put it up for auction. Yeah. $7,000.
Ah, yeah. Well, and of course there will be no more. There's a finite property.
You love drugs,
Of course, so the Pablo Picasso...
It's on the dark side of the moon. Sorry, go ahead.
Of course, famously, Pablo Picasso used to pay his restaurant bills by doing a doodle on a napkin, didn't he?
He did indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
I've tried that, but it always...
No, me too.
With arrest and overnight in the cells.
It doesn't work, does it? No. Funny that. Funny.
I'll tell you what, Magnus Shaw. Hmm. Television reviews this week... sometimes, you know, it's sport, news, game shows, whatever. Yeah. But this week, we were driven towards the show we were to review, I was certainly anyway, by an outpouring on social media and by friends and people I know telling me, you've got to watch The Right Way, which was on BBC One Tuesday at 10:35. Now, the reason they were saying that was because, to put it mildly, it didn't go down too well with the viewing audience or reviewers or social networkers at all. The Right Way, it's Ben Elton's new, I suppose it would be classed as a sitcom, featuring this raving suburban chap right out of sitcom central casting. He had a gore-blimey daughter and her well-spoken lesbian friend. And the unfortunate typecasting continued with a West Indian cleaner who spoke her lines like the maid in Tom and Jerry. We had the camp assistant, an assertive Asian lady, a carry-on style script. Was The Right Way the right one for you, Magnus Shaw?
Well, no, a lot of people had a lot of fun with this on Twitter, and that's fine. I enjoyed them having fun. But actually, I think the time for fun is over, and I must don my angry hat. I mean, I'm absolutely incandescent about this programme.
Right.
It genuinely makes me angry. I'll tell you why it makes me angry. Because the only reason it's being screened is because of the name attached to the writer. This is written by one Benjamin Elton. And apart from that, there is no earthly reason this would ever have been commissioned, greenlit, paid for and produced, because it is the most unutterable garbage one could ever hope to see. Now, that is one thing. There's a lot of garbage on television, but it occurs to me that it is appearing on the BBC, who have a responsibility to spend our money in the most effective way to produce the most entertaining and creative television and radio that we could expect for our money. And for them to lie prostrate in front of Ben Elton in order for him to execute his absolute creative nadir is disgraceful and a complete waste of our money. Also, I know for a fact there are dozens upon dozens of smart, talented, insightful, clever writers out there who would die for a break on the BBC. They would sell their foot for 10 minutes of airtime for one of their scripts on the BBC. That this old cobbler's from somebody who really, frankly, should have been shoved out of the door and told to go and try again, in favour of all those people trying to get a break, disgusts me, and I just really, really thought this spoke ill of everybody involved of it, the cast, but particularly the BBC and Ben Elton. When Ben Elton first came to prominence, he did an interview in Q magazine, and in it he moaned about the fact that when he arrived at the BBC, there was a script floating around called Show Me the Way to Oldham. And he held this up as an example of how dreadful television comedy had become, and how stereotyped and unfunny and bigoted and sexist TV comedy had become before him and Rick and Aid and Robbie Coltrane and Nigel Planer and everybody arrived to put this all right. Well, Ben, you have just written Show Me the Way to Oldham all these years later, and you, worse, you got it commissioned.
It was so hideously old fashioned, wasn't it? It was, it was just awful. We had routines about how only a man could load the dishwasher, and these helpless women were sort of standing perplexed by the whole thing. And then there was the lady at the lead actor's workplace who expected birthday, you know, presents on her birthday, and the woman shop assistant who was, you know, happier spending time on the phone than serving a male customer, and the women were spending too long in the bathroom. He actually said, oh, she's female, she's in a bathroom, she's never going to be finished. And it felt like 1963.
Yeah. You
know, it's like George and Mildred or something.
But it went worse than that. I agree with you. The themes, such as they were tired, archaic and pointless. But worse than that, I cannot believe that somebody read through that script and let's face it, you have to get 30 signatures to get a jar of coffee at the BBC. So I cannot believe.
Got to go through compliance.
Yes.
Got to go through the compliance.
It just seems incredible to me that sufficient signatures were gained to put this into production when there were gags of the level you would balk at if you heard it in a playground of a school. They built a whole gag around the fact that buildings are sometimes called erections. They actually, Elton actually wrote that, and it was signed off by an editor, if not several editors, and then performed and made it to screen. Incredible.
And these sort of gags where, you know, a kind of giggly word was said, they weren't even like throwaway lines. They were sort of broadcast, telegraphed in advance that said, look, I'm going to talk about this, and we're going to say this word in a moment, and I'm going to say it in a kind of double entendre situation. Here it comes. Bang, there it goes. And, you know, it just fell away so awfully. You know, it's quite odious and just really grim and ghastly, really, the whole thing.
Absolutely beyond belief. If ever a man buried his talent in front of the world, then that happened, earlier in the week when Ben Elton screened this atrocity. Just dreadful.
What didn't help it was that it was oddly set up. It was a stage show. Now it sounded that the blending in of the laughter track was done quite well. I think it was recorded in a sort of sound studio, as it were. But whether there was an audience there or not, I wasn't sure. But certainly there was a laughter track wrenched upwards in there, because I simply couldn't believe that people were in a audience sitting there laughing at some of these lines. So, the worst moment for me was that he's obviously been watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, because it was a real attempt at a kind of Larry David scene in that lady's outfit is with the lady on the phone, Girl Shack, you know, and he comes in and he's the sort of grumpy customer who loses control and, you know, that whilst the assistant stays calm and everything. And yet Larry David carries this off with sort of elan and panache. Oh, yeah. But this was just like clumping in with hobnail boots.
Well, I was going to say, this doesn't belong in the same solar system as Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Nowhere near. And even the name of the town that they were supposed to be in, Basil Ricky, which is an awful sort of conflation of Basildon and Billericay, to make you think, oh, it's out in Essex. You know, it's kind of like a kind of cliched Essex generic kind of office. And I say with the camp assistant and the assertive Asian lady, and I was really perturbed by the West Indian cleaner, though, because she was you know, again, there's a cleaner. He had to make her West Indian, and he had to give her these lines that made her sound like somebody from, you know, that was emancipated from the Southern
cabin.
States.
Yeah, it really was.
And
from Ben Elton.
It's hard to marry his style on this and the chap that I even worked with briefly for a while back on Friday Night Live and Saturday Live. It bears no resemblance to the chap that, you know, was standing up and able to talk at so many words per minute, almost off the top of his head every week. And, you know, just seemed like the bright young hope future for comedy in the following decades.
Quite astonishing. And I would suggest that there is an argument for axing this. Not that the BBC will, because the money's been spent, but I cannot see any reason to progress with this.
I agree with you. You know, it struck me as well. Will they be brave enough to look at this? One or two of the newer heads of whatever at the BBC, new controller and whatever, and think, actually, this is doing us more harm than good. Let's pull it. As you say, they tend not to these days because of the money spent on it. But I would.
Yeah, I would.
I'd pull it off.
Yeah, I would.
Altogether. Phil McIntyre production for the BBC, The Right Way, BBC One, Tuesday, 10:35. And we'll see if it survives the coming weeks.
What? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, making sure it's time for our final feature on the podcast, which is the Pretend iPod, where we each choose a piece of music, a track, and explain why it's meaningful to us. And then it ends up on the Pretend iPod on the Rocking Vicar website, and indeed on Spotify, under mysteriously your name, Magnus Shaw.
Yes, yes.
What are you bringing to the Pretend iPod?
Well, we were just touching on the mid-80s with Saturday Night Live and the Ben Elton and Harry Enfield and all that. And I'm going to continue in that vein. Talk a little bit about when I was a jobbing disc jockey in the mid to late 80s. Weddings, bar mitzvahs, nightclubs, bars. You know, I pretty much play records for anybody who wanted to pay me. And I was fortunate enough whilst doing that to get on a few record company mailing lists, and I get sent various bits and bobs through, most of which, as you'd expect, were tripe from bands nobody had ever heard of and never heard from again. And my actual own personal tastes were very much post-punk variety at that time. You can imagine Killing Joke, Theatre of Hate, The Cult, etc., etc. So anything that got sent to me got a very, very sceptical viewing, or listening, perhaps I should say. So I was pretty much a tough nut to crack when promotional records were sent through. But, and it must have been around 1988, so towards the end of the 80s, I received a track by Womack and Womack, who, for the uninitiated, are husband and wife team, Linda and Cecil. Now, Linda is the daughter of Sam Cooke, Cecil the brother of Bobby Womack. So that's quite some pedigree. This record was called Teardrops. And I was really, really impressed with it, even though it was completely outside the sort of genre that I favoured. It was like stripped back soul with an unbeatably hooky chorus. And consequently, I played it for weeks at my gigs, and it was a big hit, became a big hit as well, so everybody was happy. But what it also made me do was go and investigate the Womack and Womack back catalogue, which was a completely closed book to me, and actually led me to their 1983 album, Love Wars. And the title of Love Wars is my pick for this week. I cannot overemphasize how much I loved this song when I discovered it, and that hasn't diminished in any shape, way, or form right up to this day. It's loaded with impeccable harmonies from Cecil and Linda. A proper soul funk beat. And this is in an era when Lindrums were all over the place. Electronic drums were everything. But this has got a very organic feel to the backbeat. This quite surprising gritty lyric, if you apply your ears to it, actually, you know, concerning a couple who've actually been abusing each other for years and now begging each other for a truce. It is not a light, airy, fairy lyric in any shape, way, or form. And miraculously, this single all but evicted The Cult, Spirit of Destiny, New Order, all the others from my turntable at the time. I just played it, much to the surprise, as you can imagine, of my fellow post-punk rockers. They thought I'd gone slightly nuts, but I just loved it. And anyway, what did they know? Because by turns, this record is rich and minimal and lush and tough, and a song which surely, if there's any justice, gained Cecil an express pass through the pearly gates when he left us back in February. Mm-hmm. It's that good. It always will be, and it is my pick for the Pretend iPod this week. It's Love Wars as a single or as the title track from the album Love Wars, and it's by Womack and Womack.
It's relevant that you mentioned the Sam Cooke connection there, because when I noticed that you'd chosen this, I thought, oh, I'll go to YouTube and remind myself of it. And the very first search return on YouTube for Womack and Womack's Love Wars is their appearance on Top of the Pops at the time of it being a hit. And it's introduced by Simon Bates. And then at the end, as it fades out, there's just a brief smidgen of Peter Powell and Simon Bates. And Simon Bates is at his most gloopiest. it's like, Womack and Womack there. And she's Sam Cooke's daughter, he throws in. it's the way he says it. I do recommend it. It makes you want to punch the screen. Abraham Laboriel on bass, I always remember. That's the thing I remember about Womack and Love Wars, because this is one of the great session players of all time.
Cecil, quite a handy bass player as well, I see.
Absolutely. They were great because they didn't, in my view, didn't go for the sort of poppiest of pop hits. They brought a touch of kind of thought and a little intellect into what they were doing. As you say, there was a message in there, and it had just something just a little bit different, a bit special about in those days.
Very recognisable as well. Their sound was very much their own. You could recognise a Womack and Womack song straight away. Yeah, but probably the harmony really between Linda and Cecil. I suppose he would be Cecil being American, wouldn't he?
I think he's Cecil. And Magnus, she's Sam Cooke's daughter.
And indeed she is. Yeah. How about
number 25?
How about that, mate?
Pop for you. Yes, indeed. We've just had a couple of days of sunshine in the south of England, and so as is traditional, I rolled back the roof of the car, fired up the Spotify reggae playlist, and pretended it was summer with the cool ruler deliciously, exquisitely smoothing out the journey home. I'm referring, of course, to Jeremy Irons, Oscar-winning actor. Gregory Isaacs. I always get those two mixed up. It's easily done. Yeah, Jeremy Irons.
Look very similar as well.
Yeah, Gregory Isaacs, exactly. Almost like brothers. Yeah. Gregory Isaacs, at any punk gig in the mid to late 70s, there would always be a tape playing in between the bands, and that tape would always be reggae, and always featured would be Gregory Isaacs. And through the exposure of the publicity generated by punk's love affair with reggae, and with DJs like David Rodigan giving lots of airplay to his sumptuous version of Lover's Rock, by the late 70s, Gregory Isaacs was one of the most popular reggae artists in the world, probably only eclipsed by Bob Marley. And like so many reggae artists of the 60s, 70s and 80s, Gregory Isaacs had terrible record deals. And the confusion over royalties and rights, we can see that by the fact that there are over, 500 Gregory Isaacs albums available, most of them on Spotify, and most of them pressed up to give everyone except Gregory Isaacs a few quid. Mm. And Gregory Isaacs' life story is not a happy one. Just as he was breaking through after signing to Island Records, he was arrested for the 27th time and was jailed for 6 months. And around this time, Gregory, he was a good-looking, handsome chap. He dressed with a sort of suave insouciance, which led to his nickname, the Cool Ruler. And he had great success, as they say, with the ladies. But that spell in prison also led to the news that he was addicted to crack cocaine. and his good looks were destroyed. Most of his teeth fell out due to the effects of the drugs. And although there were several attempts, he had several attempts at a comeback. Essentially, he ruined his voice. And his last years were spent in South London, where he died in 2010. He was only 59 years old. But from his golden period, when his voice ruled the world of reggae, I've chosen from 1978 the wonderful My Number One. Super smooth, effortless, stylish, sensual. There are dozens of versions, dub, remixes, the lot. But we're sticking with the original, recorded sometime 1977 or 78, and released on the GG label. And no show on the UK and US charts. 3 minutes, 28 seconds, the cool ruler, Gregory Isaacs, My Number One.
Yeah, you'd think somebody calling himself the cool ruler would be, irritatingly arrogant and up themselves. And indeed, he did have a high opinion of himself. But when you see photos of Gregory Isaacs, you can kind of concede it, can't you? Because he really was very, very cool.
He was always a hat tilted to the back of
exactly.
his head. A suit, a nice shirt.
Yeah.
Tidy dreadlocks and an eye for the ladies at
the
front.
Well, that's right. But Bob Marley, renowned for his sort of casual dress, wasn't he? T-shirts and denim shirts and stuff. And Isaacs went the other way. It was sort of almost mod way, didn't he? He was always well turned out.
Yes. What he did have in common with Marley is that rather abominably, really, both lost count of the number of children.
I can well imagine that being true. It doesn't seem that long ago since I saw Gregory Isaacs at the Summer Sunsplash do in Burgess Park, just off the old Kent Road. But it must have been 95, perhaps, when he headlined that. He didn't seem in too bad fettle, but he'd obviously aged a lot. And as you say, the drugs were eating into him by then. But,
absolutely. To watch his career downturn really is the greatest anti-drugs message that you could ever have, because he did continue to use drugs right towards the end. And it just tore him apart from inside, lost all his teeth. It was lung cancer that finally took him away, but it basically his body was just on the verge of collapse.
Sure. And interesting you should pick My Number One, because of course the probably his best known work is Night Nurse, which is also phenomenal. That's a very tremendous record. So good pick Gregory Isaacs. Fabulous. Perhaps we should have a little bit more reggae on the pretend iPod as we go into the summer. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Oh, I'm always bring a bit of reggae in. Good man.
And, as regular listeners will know, the second pick for the pretend iPod is our cue to depart. Thanks very much for your company, Mr. Dacom. You are a gentleman and a scholar. And, of course, you guys at home, good to be with you. And I hope to see you again in perhaps a little over 7 days due to, my holiday, to be perfectly honest, but we'll look forward to it nonetheless. See you in 7 or 8 days, something like that. God bless. Bye bye.
Have to admit the heart go under, but it's taking me under since you're not here. Oh, I feel so all alone. It's bitter when it's hard to get, but this hiding go soon. It's making me weak. Moving all over now. I promise to stop boxing you round, so don't scratch my face. In the ballet. Oh, the fight is all over now.
We need to get our act together, take it on the street, bring it on home, and drop them guns on the floor.
We don't need. I have.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.
Right, said Fred, give a shout to Charlie. Up comes Charlie from the floor below.
Linda and Cecil Womack with Love Wars.
And Linda is Sam Cooke's daughter. Let's take the charge.